Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, judging Brett Kavanaugh. And Richard, big enough news today that we've got you joining us from your travels in Europe. Thanks for being with us. We had President Trump announce earlier this week that Brett Kavanaugh, judge on the D.C. Circuit, is his nominee to replace Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. So let me just start here, actually. The president was famously working off this list of potential justices that had been put together for him with the consultation of people like the Federalist Society. And the general consensus amongst people right of center, even those who dislike the president, is that this is about as solid a list as one could hope for. And before we got Judge Kavanaugh's name, some of the other names that we heard floated as finalists were people like Amy Barrett, Ray Kethledge, Thomas Hardiman. Help us non-experts parse this lineup. Any substantive differences that you'd underscore in picking Kavanaugh as opposed to one of those others?
I don't think the differences here are substantive. I think Kavanaugh presents a high return and a high risk. Of the four that you mentioned, he's the only one who sits on the D.C. Court of Appeals, and that's famously understood to be the court that looks most like the Supreme Court, which these days has largely become a constitutional law, public law, administrative law court. And that's the kind of docket that you have in the D.C. Circuit. So one advantage is that you know what he thinks on this because he's written stuff for the last 10 years. And I think the first maxim that everybody had in this thing on the Republican side, the FedSoc side, or whatever side you wish to call it, was no more David Souters. You might recall that when David Souter was appointed by George H.W. Bush. He was recommended by, I think it was Warren Rudman, coming out of New Hampshire. He was a great guy. He had served a grand total of one day or so on the First Circuit. He comes on the court, and he's center-left rather than right, rather than center-right. And if you knew who number two was on the list, namely, I think it was Edith Jones of the Fifth Circuit, the difference between her and him was night and day. She is probably on the far right side, if you look at this thing, close to Justice Thomas in one way or another. And so you could see that the people who cared about this were really upset about the fact that they gave one away to the other side. It wasn't going to happen again. And Kavanaugh has a long track record. He's a very smart guy. There's no mystery. So that's the good side. That's also the bad side, because what happens is the Democrats now have 300 opinions to shoot at, and nobody bats 1,000. And so you can start writing indignant letters about this, that, or the other kind of opinion and try to rally the troops around you. He's a focal point. If they had picked somebody like Ray Kethledge, who's also a very distinguished judge and a fine gentleman, coming out of the Sixth Circuit, he's had a couple of decisions on Fourth Amendment stuff going to the Supreme Court, but he's not primarily in a circuit that does administrative law. And so there's less to attack him for on those grounds, but there's less ability to predict what he's going to do when he's getting there. I think most people believe that if you're trying to figure out where Kavanaugh will sit on this spectrum, Justice Thomas is kind of in a class by himself. And one would think of Kavanaugh along with Gorsuch and Alito as being part of the strong sort of middle right wing, clearly distinguishable in some ways from John Roberts, who's a bit further over to the center than the two of them. And at that particular point, you're taking Kennedy, who's probably a bit closer to the center than John Roberts, and replacing him with somebody to the right of Roberts, which is why it is that I think people are so upset. Why is it not somebody like Amy Barrett? I think there are probably two reasons for this. One is she's also very, very new when it comes to sitting on the circuit court, and that means it's something of an unknown. Secondly, I think that there's a reason to keep her off, because if Ruth Ginsburg is the next to retire and there's going to be a lot of pressure to appoint a woman, she becomes a very plausible candidate. She'll have another year of experience. The other reason, I think, is that, you know, the whole thing that got Dianne Feinstein so worked up about religion, Catholicism, abortion, originalism, and all that box is something that would make her subject to a very heavy attack as well. Now, will this work? I mean, you know, McConnell is a consummate status, you know, strategy. I can't say the same thing about Schumer. He wears his heart on his sleeve. I think he kind of overstates his case. But the Republicans have a grand total of one defection that they can suffer. Then it becomes maybe two. Then it becomes 49-49 and Pence goes there. There are three Democrats they could pick off, I think, you know, the customary three from Indiana, Wisconsin, rather, West Virginia and so forth. And I guess there's one other.
North Dakota, I think, is the other one.
Dakota, that's right. It's Heidi Heitkamp, North Dakota, right? So, you know, you get all of these people out there. You may pick off them. The Democrats are going to work furiously to pick off Lisa Murkowski and to pick off Susan Collins coming out of Maine. I don't follow the Beltway stuff particularly well, but you can see essentially this thing may well turn on the sentiments of five justices. And, you know, what would have happened if you had nominated any of the others? My view about the Democrats is it's twofold. One, it's revenge time. They think that the Gorsuch nomination was stolen from Merrick Garland. I think that's wrong. In fact, the one compliment I would give to the Republicans on this stonewalling operation is by not having a hearing, they didn't have to spend their time defaming somebody, parsing all of his opinions, saying what an outrageous human being is, which is what's going to happen to Kavanaugh, whose every step is going to be criticized and abused and so forth. You read some of the characterizations of him, criticisms of him. It's sort of one sentence, zingers, all indignation, all inaccurate, all oversimplified. I think some of that would have happened to all of the other Republican nominees. The only possible exception to that is Hardeman. I have to say, I don't know very much about him or his work. I've never heard a bad thing about him, but he doesn't have the kinds of reputations that the other three judges have had. And again, you know, if you're trying to get somebody through, that's a good thing. If you want to know what you're going to get when you get them through, it's kind of a bad thing. And so there's this constant trade-off that's going on here. And I would say that Kavanaugh's getting this confirmation is by no means a lock. I would guess the odds are probably around 2-1 in his favor.
To your point about the confirmation hearings, I mean, these things are sort of, they're famously predictable insofar as you tend to get the senators grandstanding either in favor of or in opposition to the nominee. And then the nominee himself usually doesn't say all that much because of an aversion to commenting on cases that might come before the court. Do these hearings serve a useful purpose despite that, or would you like to see changes in the way that we confirm justices to the court?
Well, I don't believe that the nominee should ever testify, precisely because they're going to play rope-a-dope the whole time. If you recall, Elena Kagan wrote an article before she was nominated when she says, I'm all in favor of judicial candor. Then when her nomination came up, she played the same game that everybody else played. There's nothing you can say that will help you. There's anything that you can say will hurt you. And in fact, if you start to say certain things that compromise your independence, it would be a disaster. So suppose Senator Schumer came up and said, look, I want to know, you wrote about Roe v. Wade when you were sitting on the Court of Appeals, where you sit now, and are you basically going to vote to keep this opinion alive, and so that the law and constitutional protection of abortion remains as is? He can't answer that question, to my mind. I mean, he's not sitting there as a lower court judge, and so he can't say that it's settled precedent. Precedent is still persuasive at the Supreme Court. But it's not binding the way it is on a court of appeals. I've always thought from the time I wrote about this opinion back in 1973 that Roe was a fatally flawed constitutional opinion, but it's been around for about 45 years, which surely makes a difference. And the American sentiment, I think, is pretty clear. Two-thirds of the people in this country basically support Roe, and two-thirds of the country believes that abortion raises serious moral doubts and ought to only be done under more or less extreme circumstances. That's where the political equilibrium is. It would be a disaster for the Republicans in some sense if it turned out that Roe was reversed, because then you would have a split in the Republican a coalition between the economically liberal and the religiously conservative individuals. I don't know how important this is in the grand scheme of things. My colleague Jerry Rosenberg always likes to quote that the year before Roe v. Wade, or maybe it was 2 years, there were 250,000 legal abortions in the United States. It seems to me if Roe were overturned, what would happen is at the state law level, there'd be a lot of state Supreme Courts from liberal states which say that, hey, Roe is still the law of this state under our state constitution. There'd be other state legislatures that would pass laws that legalized abortion under these circumstances. There'd be some states that would be strong holdouts for one reason or another. It would be a complicated situation. Everybody would still, I think, be able to get an abortion. That is, every woman would be able to get one, but she may have to travel out of her home court in order to do so. It'd be a royal mess, but I don't think that it would be the kind of cataclysm where no abortion would be legal anywhere in the United States, which is often the picture that's put up there. But if I were a justice, I'm since I'm never going to be asked this question by the Senate, I take the position that I took in my book on the classical liberal constitution, said, you know, stare decisis, the prescriptive constitution, it's like adverse possession. Somebody with a wrong decision stays on property for a long period of time. After a while, it becomes a good piece of property. We do that all the time as a matter of constitutional law. Marbury and Madison was wrong as a matter of text. It turns out there's no federal jurisdiction over corporations under diversity if it's a matter of the original text. There's just lots of things that we've done now for 200 years to protect against flaws in the Constitution that we let ride. Sometimes we don't. Nobody, I think, wanted to make the long-term stare decisis argument for Plessy v. Ferguson, even though it was on the books 58 years before it was overturned in 1954 in Brown v. Board of Education. So those are really high-tension decisions. The Democrats don't want to face that. They regard Roe as holy scripture. But one of the things that's so clear about it is you don't get arguments about whether things are right or wrong anymore when you do these constitutional debates. They're all presented as irrefutable facts of nature. And so Roe is not only right, but essentially comes from on high. It's like a natural law doctrine of one form or another. And that's one of the tragedies of the public debate on these issues. Is there no close cases? There's no trade-offs that you have to make. There's no reasonable doubt. There's no dual interpretation. It's just, we don't like your guy, and anything we can say to slam him, we're going to do. And Kavanaugh is going to be subject to a level of abuse, I think, that's going to even exceed that which took place with respect to Gorsuch, because this is a larger transformation in the way the court works. And if Ruth Ginsburg retires or becomes disabled or dies, which is, you know, something like this is quite likely in the next year or two, given her age and her health, now you're going to have Trump appointing a third appointee, right? And this one will be conservative replacing a liberal. You'll hear that noise all the way to where I'm sitting in Budapest, Hungary at the time we're doing this tape recording.
Looking at his record on the bench thus far, what do you, Richard, regard as the biggest substantive strengths and weaknesses of Brett Kavanaugh as a potential Supreme Court justice?
Well, I think the biggest strength is the guy is bloody smart, extremely conscientious, works very, very hard at what he does, is generally, you know, widely respected inside the profession as being a serious intellectual. You know, you recall that when Trump was appointed president, there were a bunch of people, mainly originalists, says, we can't trust this man as president of the United States. We don't know what he's going to do. And I signed that note, and people said, why did you sign that note? You're not an originalist. I said, well, I'm close enough to an originalist for these purposes, even though I have my own variation. But I have that same sense. And then after McGahn and Leonard Leo took over, I mean, you can say, well, some people on this list are more plausible than others. There large numbers of people on that list whom I regard as friends, others whom I don't know but whom I admire. And I think everybody says it's kind of a who's who's on the conservative side. And that's one of the things that makes the Democrats a little bit crazy. This is not trying to appoint Harold Carswell, who had no visible qualifications for anything when Nixon tried to appoint him in 1971. These are all grade A candidates. So what you have to do is, now you can't attack them on intelligence and so forth. You have to attack them because of their record prior to going on the court, and I gather Kavanaugh did work with Ken Starr. Well, that's a can of worms. I don't think it's even relevant as to what happened in those particular cases, but the Democrats will beg to differ on that. You got 300 opinions, every one of which could be misread, every one of which has to be read. And generally speaking, it takes a lot less effort to mischaracterize an opinion than it does to correct it. So the Democrats have a natural advantage in there to the extent that they oversimplify. There was a letter written, I believe, I read it by alumni who was saddened that Heather Gerken said nice things. She's the dean of the Yale Law School about Kavanaugh. And then they went in, you know, for many pages, giving one or two sentences about a variety of cases. There were no links in the letter that I saw to read the particular opinion. I don't know all of them, obviously, but the ones I knew, I just thought were wildly oversimplified denunciation. But that's exactly what happened to Robert Bork. That's exactly what happened to Clarence Thomas. It is interesting, you know, the Republicans have yet to do this to anybody on the Democratic side, because both Breyer and Ginsburg were appointed with pretty strong support. Whereas every one of the Republican nominees, you know, that we've had since Souter, who was kind of a half Democrat, as we know, like Thomas and so forth, Alito and Roberts and Gorsuch, have all been subject to absolutely frontal assaults. And we're already seeing that happening with respect to Kavanaugh. It's really quite something to watch, even from a distance. You're 8 hours ahead or 8 hours behind and whatever it is. But the intensity of the opposition is really quite extraordinary. The hearings, as you mentioned, have nothing to do with changing anybody's mind. The question here is, do you look good and can you play gotcha? So my view is you should have the hearings, to go back to your original question, but the candidate should not be asked to testify. And people who want to haul off on him should be given an opportunity to do so. And those who want to defend him should be given an opportunity to do so. The fact that the main attraction is absent, I think, reduces the importance of the hearing, the willingness to grandstand, and I regard that as all to the good. I don't believe anything said at the hearings, apart from an outright blunder of the kind which you probably ought not to try to trap people in, could ever change a single vote. Nobody's going to change the vote of Elizabeth Warren or Charles Schumer.
So the final question that I'll put to you, Richard, we've only got a couple minutes left. What you've heard from a lot of conservatives in response to the liberal outcry over Kennedy's retirement is them saying to the left, you know, the fact that you think one justice on the Supreme Court is an extinction level event sort of underscores the problem, which is to say that the judiciary has become too powerful a force in American government. It was never meant to have this much power relative to the other two branches. And to the extent that you guys are falling apart over this, you're being hoisted on your own petard. How much sympathy do you have for that argument?
Not a huge amount. Look, I wrote a book called Takings, which happily declared on page 281, the entire New Deal apparatus is unconstitutional. This was not an argument for pure libertarianism. It was an argument to say that when you use systems of taxation, regulation, and so forth, you're trying to create Pareto improvements, that is, situations where everybody, or at least one person at least, is better off and nobody is worse off, hardly an asocial objective, and that the New Deal with its endless transfer schemes essentially reduced the size of the pie and try to create larger slices for some people, which meant very much smaller slices for other people. And so, you know, this is a pretty powerful judicial position. I might add, by the way, this was actually the way in which the law had operated until 1937, pretty much on that thing. And all I can say at that particular situation is that the level of prosperity that we had during the so-called Lochner era was unparalleled in human history. It's one of these sort of great contradictions. The progressives come out in the entire period, say between 1900 and 1930, saying the sky is falling in. You've basically have said that yellow door contracts and collective bargaining, yellow door contracts illegal, collective bargaining is unconstitutional. And what do you have? You have the greatest increase in wages relative to productivity in the history of the United States. The standard of living in 1940 was so unrecognizably different from anything in 1870, the beginning of that era, it was a great triumph. And, you know, I'm proud of the fact that much of this was made possible by a form of judicial intervention. The key difference then was, it was an intervention because most people tended to believe that this was the right order. And so you certainly had a tax on it, but there was a very solid, comfortable majority of people who were willing to live with that. Once you get to the New Deal, the progressives are coming in. And now I'm not a real fan of judicial activism anymore because it's activism in the transfer society, not activism in the growth society. So depends on what these Republicans want to do. I never, ever sort of give my blank card to anybody on any issue. I mean, for example, recently I'm working on some stuff about oil states, which is a complicated case having to do with federal jurisdiction and patent cases. And I thought Justice Thomas was completely wrong. It was also the case that he commanded a majority of most of the conservatives and the liberals, led by Stephen Breyer, who I regard as being hopelessly deferential on the Chevron frontier to legislative action. And now the dissent is with Justice Roberts, who's normally kind of towards the middle, in a very strong opinion written by Gorsuch. So my own sense about this is, yes, I do think there's kind of rich ironies in this, but I never want to take a kind of a position which says, ah, this is judicial activism, ah, this is judicial passivity. You got to look at the case. The funniest illustration of this is, of course, the Kelo case. Justice Stevens writes this opinion which says that you can take somebody else's land for economic development, even if you have not the slightest idea of what you're going to do with it once you've taken it over, so that the Miss Kelo's former house is now a garbage dump because they never got to build anything on that particular land. And he was accused of judicial activism. It wasn't activism. It was extreme deference to the legislature, saying the phrase public use means whatever the legislation says it does. So there's no constitutional constraint on what they can do. And it was a public relations disaster. The deference could be as dangerous as the intervention. And so that's not the way in which I look at this. I think you have to be much more granular. You have to look at each of these particular cases. And there are many areas where I'm quite deferential to the legislature because I think that there's no other way you can do things. I don't think that you want to use the cruel and unusual punishments with an S on the end of it to say that you can't give the death penalty for rape. But on the other hand, I think that you can make fairly powerful arguments that the minimum wage is per se unconstitutional in any kind of a competitive economy. And I can explain and defend both of those positions, but I cannot do it with a kind of broad brush situation which says, gotcha. You guys are interventionists. You guys are interventionists. Everybody's interventionist on some issues. My view is the question as to whether or not they're right or whether or not they're wrong. So to give you one last illustration, since I'm on the side of a rant, what you do is, you look at Roe v. Wade, a massive judicial intervention by people saying, oh, Lochner v. New York was really horrible. Lochner preserved the status quo before new legislation. Roe v. Wade struck down legislation in every state in the United States dealing with the abortion question. We get to Obergefell. This same-sex marriage was going to be legalized, I think, pretty much by statute everywhere. And what they do is they come in, these judicial minimalists, and they strike all that stuff down. And I would never have done that. I don't think there's anything in the Equal Protection Clause that drives you to that particular result. But my argument isn't based upon the badness of judicial intervention. It's based on a close reading of what equal protection means and how it gets misconstrued in this case. So on these issues, I'm more granular. I'm more at the retail level. I don't like grand Republican arguments in favor of judicial restraint. I don't like grand Republican arguments in favor of activism. And I feel the same way about Democrats in both those directions.
All right. Thank you, Richard, and thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.